Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Tuesday, January 19th, 2016. I'm your host, Scott Burton. On today's show, we'll talk with Bob Banghart about the Alaska State Museum. We'll get a preview of Tony Yorba's World Affairs Council presentation about his personal journey to Germany to retrace his father's fateful mission during World War II. We'll talk with Susanna Mischler about her upcoming writing workshop. Andy Klein will tell us about AK Beer Week. And our high school principals will be here to tell us about information nights to help 8th graders make the right high school choice. Those interviews, National Native News, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more right here on a Juno Afternoon. Currently 34 degrees at the Juno Weather Office.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Public transit service is coming to an Alaska tribe on the Kenai Peninsula to help address high transportation costs. The Federal Transit Administration recently awarded the Ninilchik tribe a $300,000 grant to get the service started. KBBI's Daisha Eaton has more.
So we have a two-bay garage. We're looking at probably getting 15 passenger buses to start with and probably looking at getting two of them.
That's Daryl Williams, showing me around the garage where the buses will go. It's attached to the Ninilchik tribe's 4,000-square-foot transit building. Ninilchik is a tiny town on the central Kenai Peninsula, sandwiched between Soldotna and Kenai to the north and Homer to the south. Williams, who is in charge of the project, says the community is perfectly positioned to become the transit hub for the region.
Originally, we had planned to do local services. Lately, we're actually trying to evaluate extending that service to Soldotna, Kenai, Homer.
There are several other ways to get around the Kenai Peninsula, a transit service called CARTS, but you have to make a reservation, and it doesn't serve the southern Kenai Peninsula. There are also taxi cabs, but they're expensive, running $100 or more to hub communities. William says the tribe has been searching for a solution for some time. They eventually decided to try to solve the problem themselves.
We've already bought the property. We've already built the building. This is really one of the final steps to be able to actually make the service happen.
Williams says the tribe did a survey in 2015, asking tribal members what services they would like to see the tribe providing. Public transportation ranked at the top of the list. Ivan Enseleski is the executive director of Ninilchik Traditional Council. He says there are lots of reasons his people want the transit to go to town.
We have elders programs where, you know, they need, say, access to the pharmacy, or even in some of our social services programs where they have to, say, take courses, go up for court-ordered things.
They say the transit project will create several new jobs in their community, and they hope to have buses up and running on their routes sometime this summer. I'm Daisha Eaton.
The new book, Home, Cheyenne River Lakota Nation, incorporates photos of life on the Cheyenne River Sioux Reservation in South Dakota. As Jim Kent reports, it was created with the wisdom of tribal elders and the perspectives of young people.
Heather Steinberger's primary goal in creating her book was to counter what she says are the usual media images of reservation life.
When people heard about reservation life in the media, it was largely focused on the social ills that are present there, the poverty that's present there, and it was just a very dismal perspective of these communities, that everything was sadness and despair.
Steinberger's plan was to scour the massive Cheyenne River Reservation with two photographers, capturing as many facets of its life and people as she could. Then Steinberger matched those images with the words of the reservation's youth. Home is where you come from, who you grew up with, and what you believe in. From an essay by Keith Jewett is one example of those words. Marcella LeBeau is a respected elder of the Cheyenne River Sioux tribe. LeBeau says she's happy that her image is among those that fill the pages of Heather Steinberger's book.
We have so much beauty here, and some people fail to see it. The birds, the animals, and the trees, and we have lots of beauty here.
The cooperation of the students with the book project, says Steinberger, was remarkable. From poems to essays to short memoirs, the Cheyenne River Reservation students shared their innermost thoughts and feelings in a book that can be read by the world. I'm Jim Kent.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation.
with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation is accepting artwork and reservations for the Alaska Native Art Auction February 18, 2016 in Anchorage, Alaska. Over 400 business leaders and executives attend this annual event. Proceeds benefit Kiwanis News Program. Learn more at knba.org. The Albuquerque Chamber of Commerce's Convention and Tourism Department welcomes the Gathering of Nations to the Wise Pies Arena, a.k.a. The Pit, April 29th and 30th. Information on services and the Gathering of Nations at ahcnm.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, January 19th, 2016. Scott Burton, your host, is about 6 minutes after the hour. And joining me now in the studio is Addison Field. He is the Chief Curator for the Alaska State Museum and Deputy Director of the Libraries, Archives, and Museum. Mr. Bob Banghart, welcome to the show, gentlemen.
Good afternoon, Scott.
Hey, Scott.
It's nice to have you here, and I think today we're going to talk about all things SLAM. What do you think?
It's pretty much a dominant subject of the household.
I'll tell you what, it's looking good.
It sort of towers over your building, doesn't it?
It's big.
Yeah, I know Bill talked about how he likes to sit at his window and watch the success out there, so that's good.
It's looking good. So, Bob, you were saying projected opening mid-May.
Well, we're still on schedule in the broad scope, and we're looking to hopefully open the building to the public mid-May. We've been told we'll be in mid-April to move staff in, and it'll take us a month or so to get staff settled in and get them relocated from other facility. And then looking towards somewhere in the mid of summer to do a dedication, ribbon cutting, speech making, those kinds of things. So it's I think we're not going to bleed it in over a period of time. I don't think there's any real need to rush into anything. It's going to be around for a while.
Yeah, absolutely. Bob, will you start by walking us into the building and then maybe hand it to Addison at some point? I think we've all kind of seen the outside. We've all driven by and checked it out. What's it going to be like once we're inside?
The entrance is in the same location as the old entrance is off of Whittier Street. So when you walk in, come in through the foyer, to your immediate right will be a small coffee shop cafe. To your immediate left would be a small bookstore, museum, gift shop. And you walk in, you'll look down on the floor, and you'll see it's a terrazzo map with the lat and longitude lines that is in true north. It's Alaska, Canada, and Russia. And it's absolutely stunning what they're doing. It's all made on site. These guys were down there on their hands and knees bending the shape of the state in there. And there's the Yukon River and Denali and some other features. And we've got in some of the, I think, half a dozen plus communities. So that occupies the whole store floor, and then it goes all the way down into the end of the public space. And then at the very end of that is the new eagle tree, which is going in right now. They're putting the branches on, and the nest is being constructed, and it reaches from ground level up to, I'd say, about 34 feet, somewhere
something
in
like
that region.
Yeah.
And it's looking really, really good, and it's cast from one that we took down here and shipped back to the shop in Minneapolis that's making it. So it looks, you got to get pretty close to know it's not really real. That'll be, then the museum entrance is to just past the gift shop to the left. And then there's this large staircase that takes you up to the mezzanine area, which would be on your right. And then the mezzanine has got a full complement of casework that runs from one end to the next. It's floor to ceiling. That will be an area that will allow public access to on short notice, as well as for the institution. Then you continue up the stairs to the second floor, where there's a landing that bridges over between the administrative area and the library space. Our 1% is integrated throughout the building. It's not standalone stuff. We've got a cast glass artist, and he's made balustrades for the glass railings, some work for the walls. He was involved with design of the courtyard out front. So it's all part of a composite. It's not just standalone pieces. And there's Martin Shelton is a Juno-raised woodworker that's got a bunch of bench work that's going in there. And then Yvonne Zerbitz from Ketchikan got the other commission. So as you go upstairs to the administration, which is just desks and heads on one side, Then on the left, on the south side, is the reading room. And if people saw the newspaper photograph, it's got this grand ceiling in there. It's this wood slat ceiling. So that be the public area for library. In there will be Yvonne's piece, which is running about 80 feet by about 6-7 feet tall. It's a large glass wall that's done in her style. That's public spaces. Back of the house, whole different story. It's the staff, it's the collections, it's the portion of the building that people saw go up next to Foodland, which was the vaults, and that's where the collections are. That's been there the longest. Those are fully realized, packed full of people and material, and that's where our staff is working as they do the exhibitions that I'll pass over to Addison.
Yeah, what can we look forward to, Addison?
Right, well, coming out of the main atrium, the museum is there on the left, and folks will go through a set of glass doors and into a large lobby for visitors to the museum. On the one side, when you enter that room there, there's a couple of house posts be there to show the entrance into the museum galleries. Again, another set of large glass doors, and folks will go into the new permanent exhibits there. Immediately after entering that first gallery, there's a brand new and very imposing clan house that we've had assembled in that space as sort of the basis around which the Southeast Alaska galleries will be built. There's also a section in there on to orient visitors to the new permanent exhibits, and another section on origins. The origins, largely archaeological collections in there. There's some great archaeological fragments and some mastodon tusks and some really cool early objects. And then continuing straight in, the permanent galleries are sort of set up like a big U. And you move through southeast to the other Alaska Native sections, the Athabascan section, Yupik section, Inupiaq section, some Alaska Islands sections, and then get back to the back of the house and start working our way through the foreign voyagers and the Russian section and moving along. There's lots of really great objects that tie all these sections together. Lots of boats, starting with a Haida dugout canoe and moving to an Umiak. And coming around to a Bristol Bay double ender and a Davis boat, so it's a really exciting big objects going in. Of course, the locomotive is in there, and we've got a piece of the pipeline. Talk about some of the resource issues for the state, and it's all in the process of being installed now. So it's pretty exciting.
Wow. Save a couple days, it sounds like, to really take all that in.
So I saw a figure somewhere. Someone said, I think we're at about twice, 2.5 times more exhibition space from the old facility on permanent. But the galleries, the temporary galleries, are huge. I'd say there's an aggregate of about 8,500 square feet of temporary gallery space. Great, great gallery space. It's beautiful.
Speaking of gallery space, there's also, I understand, some rental space for the community.
That we have, there's two things that didn't get discussed on my little walk-in that I neglected. One is a multi-purpose kind of lecture hall. It's a flat floor presentation area, 120 seats. We will be fully wired to K2 360 North control booth. We can do live HD TV broadcasts from there. But that space is going to be available. It's acoustically tuned. It's got a full production facility in the back of the room. And then we also have two conservation laboratories, one for objects and one for paper, that'll be fully equipped. And we've got an objects conservator and staff. We'll be looking for a paper conservator at some point. But we're getting approached a lot by the general public about using the space. We want to do that. We just don't have the mechanisms established yet to calculate what it will cost to run the space. We have to break even on the use of the staff and security and heat and lights and stuff. But then also just what kind of events that we could hold there. The atrium itself, I think, is between 150 to 175 comfortably. And then the other room is around 120 to 150. You can get probably 150 in there without seats. They're typed out for more, but that's a comfortable allotment. And then we're in the process of defining a process of rental. And until we do that, you know, we're taking risk where people are calling up, hey, I want to rent the place in June. Well, you know, it's going to be a couple of months before we're going to be ready to make any kind of commitment to what it's going to cost, when we can do it, et cetera. So it's going to be a learning curve for everybody. And once we get in the building, we got to figure out how to make it work. So it'll be a while.
What would be your advice to a listener who is interested in that space? When should they call you?
Well, they could call me now, and I'll put them on a list.
All right.
And that's what I've done is I've just started a general list. I've taken emails, and I said, you know, this is what we can do, and I'll put you on the list and note the date and your interest, and we'll let you know when we know. We are planning this fall to host a combined conference of Museums Alaska, Alaska Historical Society, their joint conference. It's a statewide conference. It'll be here in Juneau. It's not been here for 10 years. And it'll be all of our colleagues from around the state who are anxious to see the building. And they've been very elemental in helping lobby for the monies over the last decade. So this is sort of payback for them. So we're kind of looking towards that one as really maximizing the space and cutting our teeth on how to do something right, because these people really know the difference. But not that others wouldn't, but it's going to be interesting. You know, we look at it as an augmentation of the already established leased space in the community. So we're anxious to work with CBB and the Jack and say, you guys are hosting something, you need more room, we're available, how can this all function? So I think it's going to be pretty exciting to have new space in town.
Well, we could spend the hour talking about this building, I'm sure, and I wish we could. Closing thoughts, what are you guys most proud of in this project? Maybe something else you'd like to share?
Well, every day I get an opportunity now to walk the floor and get an opportunity to go and see the building and the exhibits as they develop. And it's very exciting to see the craftsmanship and the work that is going in to turning you know, the inside of that facility that was once a concrete box into what's really going to be something for all Alaskans to be proud of.
Bob? Yeah, I would reiterate that and just say that it's been really exciting to see the growth across the board in the staff and in our supporters, and how that is mirrored by the professionalism and quality that we're seeing from the contractor and architectural and management teams. It's good fun, but it's also really seriously well-developed and delivered work.
I hope you guys come back before May and keep us updated on how things are going. And I know we're all anxiously awaiting, excited for the middle of May. That's going to be fun. Addison Field, he's the Chief Curator and Deputy Director of the Libraries, Archives, and Museums. Mr. Bob Banghart, the Alaska State Museum, thank you guys for coming on the show today.
Thank you, Scott.
Thanks, Scott.
Go catch the river, it's running out to sea line sands. Well, I've met in a mighty life savings, babe, I've got a plan. You and me, it's the story of the chrome hearts, dreams and illusions, hard to tell apart. All coffee and gasoline, all the miles in between, sunrise and sunset, and all the small towns we ain't seen yet. Where the people seem to be getting by in spite of rent. A little piece of history
Mondays are back at the Diamond Park Aquatic Center, now open Monday through Friday from 6 a.m. until 8 p.m., Saturdays 9 a.m. until 6 p.m., and Sundays noon until 6 p.m. Schedules are available online at juno.org/parkrec/diamondpark. For more information, call Diamond Park Aquatic Center at 586-2782.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, January 19th, 2016. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 21 minutes after the hour. I've been joined in the studio now by the president of the Juno World Affairs Council, Mr. Jim Clark. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Hi. Thank you for having us today.
And also architect Tony Yorba. Welcome
Hello,
to the show, Tony.
Mm-hmm.
Nice to have you here.
Yeah.
So we're
going to
be talking about Tony's presentation tonight, 5 p.m. at 360 downstairs. But, Jim, you want to give us a little...
Yeah, just a short reprise. The Juno World Affairs Council is a nonprofit, nonpartisan group that brings speakers to Juno, and in this case has a speaker in Juno who deal with issues of interest from around the globe. And certainly we're very, very fortunate to have Tony tonight speaking on a very, very interesting issue, a little different than we normally do because of the history involved here, but I'm just delighted to have him.
And like all your presentations, these are free and
absolutely
open to the public,
free,
right?
And we invite the public to come to this, and I want them to all remember WorldQuest, which will be at on February 5th at the Centennial Hall.
Another fun event. So, Tony, 3 minutes over Germany, smiling through. Is that the title of your presentation?
Yep, that's the title.
Tell us about the inspiration for this.
Well, my father was a B-17 pilot during World War II. He and his crew were shot down over a tiny village in Germany immediately preceding the second Schweinfurt raid, which was a huge raid at the time. About a year ago, a German researcher contacted me, and he said he had all kinds of information about my father's crew and what happened during the final 3 minutes of that flight. And so he invited my wife and I to Germany to kind of walk through it as sort of a journey through the past. And it was an amazing, amazing thing. You know, we talked to people that actually saw my father's plane crash. We saw pieces of it. And it got me thinking about the history, and there was so much that I didn't know about it. And so I've spent a lot of time researching it, and that's what I'll be presenting tonight.
Wow. And like most of these presentations, you usually have some slides, some pictures to show.
Oh, yeah. I was telling Jim I've got about 76 PowerPoint slides that are put together. There's a lot of history out there to see. We'll be talking about growing up and training activities, and also his time as a prisoner of war in Germany, and the forced march right at the end of the war when at Hitler's orders, the prisoners were taken from their various camps deeper into Germany where they could be used as pawns for negotiations at the end of the war.
It sounds like you learned a lot on that trip. It must have been very emotional for you, too, though.
It was incredibly emotional, yeah, when you see where an airplane crashed and you realize there were people that lost their lives there. And also a very moving, the German response to the story. I mean, it's a story that hasn't ended. It's continuing. It has a life, and there's the villagers, the people in Germany carry that experience. It was such a small town that this was probably the biggest event of the war to a lot of those people, and they remember it like it was yesterday. And a lot of this information actually comes from my mother, who's still alive, and she remembers it all like it was yesterday. So it's great having firsthand experience for some of these things.
Well, this sounds like it'll be a great presentation. That's tonight, 5 p.m. at 360 downstairs as part of the Juno World Affairs Council. As usual, it's recorded and then it's placed online.
And it will be played around, I think that 360 hits 270 sites around Alaska, so it will be well seen by the time it's over.
Okay. Again, that's 5 p.m. tonight. Tony, is there anything else you'd like to share about tonight's presentation?
Just that, you know, this is not a finished story. There's lots more to be told, and I'll continue to be working on it.
Actually, I do have one more question. What sort of has surprised you most in your research, in your trip?
The commonality of people. The experience of the Luftwaffe pilot that was credited with shooting my dad down parallels my father's. And it's really an amazing thing.
Wow. Thank you, gentlemen, very much. We'll see you tonight at 5.
Thanks.
Thank you, Scott.
I've won every battle, but I've lost every war. I'll take off my armor, set it down on the floor. My heart lies in waiting for your sorrow or your sword. For I've won every battle, but I've lost every war. The leaves go to falling from the branches again, and your wicked heart helps the season to begin. Cold winds are blowing, and I can't close the door. For I've won every battle, but I've lost every war. I've won every battle, but I've lost every. And I'll take off my armor, set it down on the floor. My heart lies in waiting for your sorrow or your soul. For I've won every battle, but I've lost every. Your touch is not tender as it once was at times. My humble knees weaken, thinking of when you mine. No longer you hold me in my face, you adore. For I've won it battle, but I've lost every war. I've won every battle, but I've lost every war. I'll take off.
Perseverance Theater presents a world premiere by Tlingit playwright Vera Starbard. Our voices will be heard. Come witness this new story of a mother's fierce love for her young daughter and the lengths she will go to protect her. This powerful play raises the question, will we stay silent when met with family violence, or will we be resilient and speak out to end the cycle? Our Voices Will Be Heard opens on January 15th. For more information and tickets, visit ptalaska.org, the Jack and Hearthside Books.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, January 19th. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 29 minutes after the hour. And joining me now on the phone is author, poet, Susanna Mishler. Welcome to the show, Susanna.
Thanks, Scott. It's great to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you. You're calling from Anchorage, is that right?
That's correct.
And did I hear it's sunny up there today?
Yes. Yes, we've had some really needed sunshine today.
Nice. Well, enjoy it for us. It's actually not too bad here in Juneau. But you'll be giving a reading from your book, Termination Dust, is that right, at Hearthside at the Nugget Mall on the 29th?
That's correct.
Okay, and then a workshop about the poetic line at Taku Graphics, which is out in Lemon Creek on the 30th, is that right?
Yes, indeed.
All right. Well, we're looking forward to it. Tell us a little bit about yourself and Termination Dust. It sounds like an interesting collection.
Oh, well, I am an electrician by day and a poet by trade, I guess. And I spent a long time on my first book of poems, which was just published last year by Red Hen Press and Boyle Books, and it's called Termination Dust, and it's a book that has a lot of different threads going through it, and it it went through the rock polisher again and again and again and again, and it's a really diverse collection. The forms of the poems and the topics are not all the same, it's available now, and it really feels good to have a book out to sort of rub shoulders with other books on the shelf and engage in that dialogue that published authors have. And, there's a lot of Alaska in this book, hence, the title, Termination Dust. I was searching for a title for it, because I felt like it was such a diverse collection, and I was having trouble getting enough perspective on it in order to kind of organize it and title it. Titles are so hard sometimes, even just for one poem, and then I was really stymied for the whole book. And I was talking or emailing with a friend who is a poet in Michigan, and I sent her a picture of a local lake in the fall with the fall colors and the mountains, the Chugach Mountains, reflected in the lake with the dusting of snow on top. And I told her, we call that termination dust here, the first snow on the mountain. And she wrote back and said, that's a juicy piece of language. That would be a good book title. And she, I realized the title of my book was just handed to me on a silver platter after literally years of searching for one. So
that must have been a great moment.
It was.
Do you have a piece you can read for us?
Absolutely. I'd be delighted. This is from the book, from the middle of the collection. And the title is Hemispheres. His half is smaller, his yellow wing darker on its leading edge. Her wing splays large, also yellow, a small triangular tear in its trailing rim. Both wings veined like a river delta, both misted with black ovals as if someone flicked ink on them as they flapped by. Their brown is the brown of an overripe banana, camouflage for fall leaves. His antenna fans, eyebrow-like, hers a smooth, penciled arch. Say the letter P into your palm, and that whisper is how their body feels perched on your hand. Their fleeced head, thorax, abdomen fuse them together. Male on left, female on right. Two sovereign hemispheres operate a moth body. This never happens to us. Our hormones make other mistakes. Even if it could, we are crosswired. Female brain would flex male thigh. Male brain would extend female bicep. The man with mincing walk, the woman with cocky shoulders, would then somehow negotiate to walk themselves as a single person to the store at first for oranges that they take home, peel at the kitchen table, and feed to each other, sticky juice dripping down their chin.
Wow, thank you for sharing that.
Sure. It was inspired by something that really happens to moths and birds and I guess some crustaceans, which is in the scientific world called bilateral gynandromorphy. So there are actually birds and moths out there with different sized, you know, each wing is a different size because half of the body is male and the other half is female, and their plumage is different if it's a bird, and they're really, you know, unique creatures. And that was probably my favorite science fact for about a year.
Did you try and get that word bilateral gynandromorphy into the poem at any point?
I did write a prose poem called Gynandromorphy that was completely different and ultimately didn't make it into this collection because I didn't think it was, as strong. And, so I kind of got it out of my system with that other poem, I guess. This particular poem, the way that it manifested, I think the word gynandromorphy would disrupt it.
I totally agree. So to hear more work like this, you'll be at the Hearthside Bookstore in the Nugget Mall on the 29th. What time does that start, Susanna?
6 p.m.
All right. And then you'll be giving a workshop where people can learn to write poetry like yours. The next day, the 30th at Taku Graphics, which is there on Concrete Way by the Lemon Creek Breeze Inn. I've heard Katrina and company have a nice space over there for workshops like this. What time does the workshop start on that Saturday, is it?
It is Saturday, 9 a.m.
Okay.
9 a.m. to noon. Yeah, it's on the Poetic Line. And, hopefully we can... folks will sort of learn to listen to their own, hear their own music and be able to translate their own music into the Poetic Line and consider, just some, all the different kinds of considerations that go into the Poetic Line. What is it, you know?
Sure.
Kind of a strange animal.
And who would be right for this class, if you will? Are these people that have never written poetry before or experienced writers?
It's designed for poets, prose writers, and readers of poetry. Anyone who's interested in the Poetic Line, you need not be writing poetry. We will do some hands-on experimentation with the line in class, but it's not really going to require you to draft a poem so much in class. Readers of poetry who just are looking for a deeper understanding of the considerations that go into the Poetic Line and are looking to deepen their understanding of poetic craft are very welcome, but as are poets and prose writers.
Okay.
Anyone who's got an interest in poetry and language, I think, would find it interesting.
And to sign up, where should somebody go?
49 writers.com.
I think org, maybe.
Yeah. Org, thank you.
Yeah, it's okay. Yeah, 49writers.org to sign up. Well, I wish we had more time to talk, Susanna. Sounds like really interesting work, and I guess we'll have to wait for the 29th and come and see it at Hearthside Nugget or take your workshop the next day.
I really look forward to my visit to Juno. Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, anytime. Thank you.
Okay, bye.
This is Bird Note. Environmental conditions shape birds' bodies, even birds belonging to the same family. For example, consider the terns. The common terns you're hearing have long pointed bills they use to catch small fish. They migrate along both coasts and through the interior in spring and fall, on their way between nesting grounds in Canada and their winter home in the tropics. By migrating, they move from one warm and productive environment to another. Their close relative, Arctic terns, look much alike, but both their bills and legs are shorter. Both species feed in exactly the same way. So why would the Arctic tern's bill and legs be shorter? Well, because Arctic terns breed in the Arctic and winter in Antarctica, they're subject to much more severe weather than our common terns. Because birds' bills and legs are not covered by feathers, they lose heat. It just makes sense, then, for birds in cold climates to have short bills and legs, and less exposure to the cold. You can compare photos of the Arctic tern and the common tern, and learn more about both, on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
The Jack is delighted to present Capital Steps, a D.C.-based comedy troupe in their 17th season of bipartisan lampooning and satirical performances. The Capital Steps provide a unique blend of musical and political comedy and will present their show to Juno based on songs from their current album, Mock the Vote. No one is safe. Barack Obama sings show tunes. Chris Christie doing classical ballet. Don't miss this one. The Capital Steps at Centennial Hall on Sunday, January 24th, 7 p.m. Tickets available at The Jack, Hearthside Books, and JAHC.org.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon. It's about 18 minutes until the top of the hour, and I've been joined by the Alaskan Brewing Company's Andy Klein. He's the communications manager, and Liz Eiler, she is the gift shop goddess.
Hello.
Welcome
to
the show.
I like your title better than mine, man.
We need
way better.
We need another one for you.
Yeah.
The communication manager. Just
hello.
Hi.
Hi. We're here to talk about beer.
AK Beer Week.
It's happening right now, and Liz and the folks at the retail are both our retail outlets, both at the brewery and also downtown at the depot, are heading up some cool activities and fun happening. And the first one's going to be this really cool thing happening. Well, actually, all week,
yes.
If people mention AK Beer Week.
That's right. They'll get 10% off of any merchandise. Doesn't include beer, unfortunately, but all of our swag, all the gear, you can receive 10% off, and that does include the depot also. So if you mention AK Beer Week, you're going to get a little prize.
That's in Lemon Creek and downtown.
Yep.
Yes.
Both locations. And then we're having on Friday, you know, about a month and a half ago, we had a vertical tasting, smoke porter vertical tasting, and it was really popular. We kind of jammed the retail shop out of the brewery.
It was.
Packed full of people. So we wanted to have something like that for AK Beer Week. So we decided to do that with the first tap of our new old growth barley wine. So this is a recipe that Jeff Larson first worked on when the brewery was in its infancy, and we do it occasionally. For people who don't know, a barley wine is really just a beer that's a very strong beer. It's a fairly, it's sort of on the sweeter side usually. It's not overly hoppy, but this beer is really interesting because it has both spruce tips and birch syrup in this beer, so it's kind of adds to that fruitiness character. It's really delicious. I got a sneak preview, actually.
Ooh.
So it's really awesome. I recommend it highly. But then we're also pouring a couple other cool things we're bringing out of the vault, right?
Yeah, we're going to bring out some of the vintage Perseverance Ale. And then we're also going to be pouring some of the 2012 barley wine. And For all of you winter fans out there, we'll be tapping the last keg of winter ale.
So that's all happening. It starts at 5 on Friday, and we're going to have like two tastings where we'll do Tudor tastings. So we'll be some brewers. I'll be there. People who kind of know more than me about the beer will be
right.
there. You know?
Thankfully.
Thankfully. And so we'll kind of have one tasting at 5 o'clock and one tasting at 6 o'clock, and we'll do it in the tasting room. And it's just $5 for that, and we're also going to be doing another thing that's really cool as part of that, which is that Panhandle Provisions and also Copa are going to have delicious food. Copa is going to have a beer.
They are. I'm really excited. Copa is making us an ice cream as we speak with the old growth barley wine. And Mark also spoke of possibly doing a ripple of birch syrup, caramel inside of it. I don't know how he's going to do this. It sounds magic. It sounds delicious. I'm really excited about it.
So wait, for $5, you get all these tastings and Panhandle Provisions, Tasty Bites, and Copa?
Right.
Yes.
From 5 to 7 on Friday. That's
right.
kind of like...
It's kind of ridiculous.
Brainer.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of like the place to be.
Can I get like a table there with a candle?
We could arrange, I don't know, maybe a live simulcast?
Night?
Yeah. Yeah.
A little simulcast on KTOO. I like that idea. Very good.
Well, that's Friday night.
So that's Friday. And then we're doing a fun thing then all day Saturday, the very first tapping of a brand new beer that no one's had yet. It's called Smash Mosaic. Smash stands for single malt and single hop. And Mosaic is the hop that we use. And Mosaic's a really cool hop because it not only brings really great complex flavor and aromatics, but it also is used when you put it in the boil, it can be used for the bittering of the beer. So it can be used for two types of things that often take two different kinds of hops. So Mosaic is a hop that can handle both of those things. And it's I've actually sneak previewed this, too, on Taste Panel. Have you?
I have not.
Yeah, and this is also really excellent. Mosaic's a really cool hop. It's got all these like really complex characteristics to it. It's both piney and floral, and it's kind of just a cool hop. It's a really hot hop in the beer industry right now. A lot of brewers out there using it. So anyway, that's happening all day on Saturday.
It must be a fun place to work at the brewery.
It's not. You'd think so. You'd think it would be fun.
Awful.
But you know, you're surrounded by beer all day,
right.
And then people having fun all the time, and it gets on you after a while.
It does.
I wouldn't recommend it.
Someone's got to do it.
But we soldier on.
Right.
We soldier
for
through.
AK Beer Week. We'll soldier
okay,
on.
Okay, so mention AK Beer Week at either of the outlets, and you get a discount, 10%.
Yeah.
And then Friday night and Saturday day. Looks like fun. More information at?
You can go to alaskanbeer.com for more info on it, and just go to our Facebook page, wherever we're talking about it all the time. Or just give us a ring or stop by the brewery.
Yeah, stop in. We can chat.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thanks for coming on.
That's what Liz does all day. She talks to people all day. Chats.
Yeah. Free beer, chatting.
It's crazy.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
Liz Zeigler's Gift Shop Goddess and Andy Klein. We'll see you on Friday night or shopping this week.
Yeah, excellent. Sounds good.
Somebody cried a tear in their beard, or a penny for every smile that Jenny gave out at the honkiest beer joint in town. 45s are on the jukebox, some old, some new. They say, hello there, pull up a chair, what can I get for you? Well, that's just small talk to help you feel at home when you come round. The honkiest beer joint in town. You're out on that side of town. You want to shoot some pool or just shoot a cool one down. Roses, pickled eggs, and sausage are by the pie.
You're listening to A Juno Afternoon here on Tuesday, January 19th, 2016. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 9 minutes until the top of the hour. I've been joined by the principal of Juno Douglas High School, Paula Casperson. Welcome to the show, Paula.
Thank you.
And also Rhonda Hickok. She's the vice principal at Thunder Mountain High School. Welcome to the show, Rhonda.
Thank you.
Nice to have you both here. So these are some important times for eighth graders. They get to choose which high school they're going to go to.
They do. As soon as the new semester starts and January rolls in, we start some of the eighth grade choice selection process. And the kickoff is tonight at JDHS at 5:30 to have our information night. And then we'll be followed tomorrow night at Thunder Mountain High School at 5:30 as well.
Excellent. And you said same presentation?
It's the same presentation at both schools. So if you can only make one night, then it's the same presentation, just to make it easier for families. Both sets of administrators will be at both schools both nights. Mm-hmm. So it's a co-presentation. JDHS, being at their school host tonight, will take the lead on the presentation. Tomorrow night, hosted at Thunder Mountain High School, and we'll take the lead on that presentation. But pretty much similar. It's the same material both nights, same PowerPoint.
I think that the difference for a lot of families will be if they want to come into the schools and get kind of a feel for it. We've invited our faculty, our parents, different activities to come and showcase if they'd like to, and that's for both of the schools. So the presentation is one small component of it, and then coming in and touring the building and interacting with current students and families is the other part of the importance of the evening.
So there might be a little home team advantage, say, when you're at Juno Douglas High School tonight.
I think, you know, the home team advantage is that you're doing tours of our schools, right?
Right.
And I think that at both schools, we've invited kind of the array of our school communities to come out and to be active in this. I think the message families will hear both nights is that the difference really is in some of the details. And so if they have questions, bring the questions. And they don't have to be whole group questions. They can, you know, find a parent if you have a question specific that a parent might answer. Find a student if you have a student-oriented question. That's why we invite so many people to come to the evenings to be resources in making a really big decision.
Right, right. Would either of you say that either high school is sort of developing strengths in one area? You know, is one high school maybe mm-hmm. better for people in the theater arts, or this one's better for math, or this one's better for science? And I don't necessarily mean better, but they focus on that.
Well, we have specific programs, I think, that are different at each one of the high schools. If you're looking at going into choice or early scholars, then Juno Douglas is really the school that you should be looking at going to.
And I'm sorry, choice and early scholars?
There are small learning communities geared towards groups of students who kind of function within like a school within a school model, or maybe for a couple of periods in the traditional school day.
Okay.
Yeah.
We also have endorsements, and so those would be like your elective classes as juniors and seniors. And those are the details we refer to.
Right.
You don't have repeated courses all the time in those endorsement areas. And so here come these eighth graders making this big choice and their parents who are making the choice with them. And the ninth grade experience is going to feel pretty similar at both schools. So we encourage them to look beyond that. And maybe in your third year science, forensic science at Thunder Mountain High School sounds fascinating. Or maybe principles of engineering at JD sounds more your style. That's the difference in the details.
Yeah. So it's really looking beyond your ninth grade year. Ninth grade really is a set of classes that's pretty similar for both school sites, and it's really pretty much beyond that. Beyond the ninth grade year is where you want to focus your planning on.
It sounds like these nights, it would probably be a good idea to go to both, right?
We have a lot of crossover in the years that we've done these. I mean, we've been doing these for many years.
I think there is a benefit for families if they have the time in their schedules. We recognize that, you know, these are weeknights. We are very busy with lots of activities and commitments. If they're able to come for that portion to start off with at 5:30 to do the tours or to ask some questions to see some of the activities and clubs that are there, that's great if they can fit both nights into it. If they can only fit one, they'll have resources from each school available, regardless of the site that they can fit into.
Yeah.
Okay. I wish we had more time, but in closing, do either of you have some advice for eighth graders? What should they be thinking about right now, A, as they make their choice, and B, as they prepare for high school?
You know, many parents, I think, are going through some challenges right now of how to figure out how to support their student and where they want to go. So really looking at that past ninth grade, really looking into your 10th, 11th, and 12th and seeing the different courses. And, of course, we're there for questions, and there's times where I, you know, let parents know, let kids know, gosh, Thunder Mountain's not the right place for you. Mm-hmm. And there are times when I say, you know, gosh, Thunder Mountain is the right place for you. So we work really well together as an administrative team to make sure that we're getting students in the right fit so that we can work on their strengths.
All right. And I would say this is a big decision. You're making a big decision, and so asking the questions, really trusting kind of the feel, like Rhonda's saying, you know, if one feels more like it's your choice than the other, you know, if you can confirm that with the information, look beyond your ninth grade year is really important. What we want is kids to pick the school they're going to stay at and kids to pick the school they're going to graduate from. It is really important, I think, for our community that we have this open choice process. And that we're discerning in how we continue to support it.
Great. And to learn more, 5:30 tonight at Juno Douglas High School and 5:30 tomorrow night at Thunder Mountain High School for information on how eighth graders can make the right high school choice. Rhonda Hickok, Paula Kasperson, thank you both so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon. Tomorrow, Jamie Waste will be your host, and he'll get an update on Eagle Crest activities with Jeff Reclow. James Hoagland and Jeff Rogers will be here to highlight this week's Queer Film Fest. We'll get an update on activities at the City Museum, and we'll get the details about the upcoming KTOO Taku Fisheries Seafood Festival. Let's take a look at the weather. Currently 34 degrees at the Juno Weather Office on the Back Loop Road, 39 in Gustavus, 39 in Hoonah, and the forecast calls for mostly cloudy conditions tonight with scattered rain showers and area of fog. Lows around 33. Tomorrow, Wednesday, cloudy, areas of fog in the morning, scattered rain showers, highs around 37. And Thursday's forecast calls for rain with highs around 35. Northwest winds 15 to 25 with gusts up to 40 there on Thursday. So look out for that around downtown Juneau and Douglas. Thanks for tuning in.